Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hello and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy parkers. I'm Daisy Buchanan, your host and the author of The Sisterhood, a love letter to the women who shaped me, published by Headline and out now. It's a book that's all about my experience of growing up with five little sisters and our relationships with the women who define our lives and how they inspire us and infuriate us. My sisters in particular are the only women I would kill for and the only women I have ever wanted to kill. The Sisterhood is available from bookshops nationwide, and buying it is the very best way for you to support the podcast. This week I've been reading Expectation by Anna Hope, which is published by Penguin this July. It's an absorbing, detailed examination of friendship, womanhood, and all of the challenges of having to live in a world where your gender defines and restricts your paths. I'm loving it, and the themes make me think of another book I absolutely adored by this week's guest, Julie Cohen. Julie's latest novel, Louis and Louise, takes a person as the central character, Louis, and explores how their life would be similar or different depending on whether they had been born a man or a woman. Julie writes so perceptively about families, longing, love and tragedy, so I wasn't surprised to learn that she's a John Irving superfan. However, there were lots of other surprises in our conversation, from her obsession with Sherlock Holmes to how she struggled to write her first Mills and Boon novel, and the fact that her award-winning, best-selling smash hit novel Together was only published due to an incredible act of bravery from Julie. Here she is. I know from conversations we have had in the past that you are a big fan of the world of Sherlock Holmes.
Yes,
I've just seen Conan Doyle and The Crimes Club by Stephen Wade.
Yeah, that's by a friend of mine who's a true crime writer and loves Conan Doyle as much as I do. We're both fanatics. When Sherlock Holmes fanatics get together, we just talk for ages about what and who's good as Sherlock Holmes and who's not good as Sherlock Holmes, and we can talk for a very long time about it.
Where did that obsession come from? Did you read the books like as a child, or is it Conan Doyle as a writer, or more the character that fascinates you?
It's the character. So I don't know if I have any on the shelves or going around the shelves. That is, do you have a mental map in your head of all your books and where they are in your house?
Oh, I really wish I did. I think Producer Dale does, because quite often I'll just be looking for something and it'll be like, it's orange. I know it's orange. And then I'll find it and it's green.
Oh, no, I know just where it is. So down here this is the only Sherlock Holmes I have right now. No, I have a few other paperbacks, but I don't have that many, which is the original illustrated Sherlock Holmes. But when I was 11 years old, I got Watership Down out of the library. And I love that book. I love it so much. But it was really thick. And I was really pleased with myself for reading such a thick book. So then I got given a book token by my aunt and uncle. And I went to the shop. And the biggest book they had on the shelf that I could afford was The Complete Sherlock Holmes, which was all 56 short stories and four novels collected in, you know, with like onion paper. It was so, so thin. And so I bought that. And I read it cover to cover. I was 11. And I fell in love utterly. And I decided at that moment that I wanted to A, live in Victorian London, B, be Sherlock Holmes. So that
all
changed
of
my
this
life.
Came from you wanting the most bang for your book.
Yeah, Yeah, it did. I just wanted, that was my pure, that's all I wanted was a big book. And then my dad was a Sherlock Holmes fan, so he was really excited when I brought it home, so we would read it together and talk about it.
So did he have any of the books in the house, or had he mentioned it before, or did he just kind of come across it? Because I suppose 11 is, I think, quite young, because those stories do get quite dark.
Yeah, they do. And then the grammar sometimes can be a little bit hard. And they are very Victorian. So there's a lot of assumptions that are made that you don't really understand when you're 11 in Maine, in America. But my dad didn't have it. My parents are interesting. So I hoard books and I have a lot of books everywhere in the house. But my mom and dad are big readers, but they're big library users because they live right around the corner from the library. So they don't own many books. They tend to read, you know, several books a week, but then have a continuing sort of circuit with the library. So the library is their bookshelf.
Was that part of your world too? Did you dream of a time when you'd have kind of your own library and books in your house? Or did you just do what they do and think, oh no, you don't keep books, you read them, you love them, they go back?
I do tend to get rid of a lot of books, but I keep a lot more than my parents do. We didn't have a bookshop in the town where I grew up. We only had a library, so the library was that was how I read everything. So I didn't own that many books as a kid, so I guess now I find them, I need to have them.
Can you remember when you first started going to the library, and were you allowed to kind of roam unsupervised, and what did you pull out the shelves?
Oh, okay. So our library in Rumford, Maine is an absolutely special place. It's a Carnegie library. So it was endowed in the 30s or the 20s, I think, by Andrew Carnegie, and looks like a lot of other libraries around the world. They all have a similar look to them. And it's beautiful, 19th century building. Sorry, it's not 19th century, 1920s, I said. What? 30s. Early 20th century building.
Are you imagining it in sort of a Victorian and it's got smoke coming out of it?
Yeah.
Like a book factory.
It's wonderful.
A man with a magnifying glass standing up beside it.
It's brick. And the upstairs is for adult fiction and nonfiction. And downstairs in the basement is children's. So, and they have separate entrances. So we would go to the library. It was just down the hill from my house. You can see it from my house. And we walked down the hill and my mom would go upstairs and I would go downstairs. And they would sort of meet in the middle to check out the books. But yeah, I could just have free reign of there. And the librarian was this woman called Mrs. Plummer, who I love. She's passed away now, but she was the most wonderful woman. And she would, if you were a regular reader, she would recommend books for you. And she would let you read almost anything you wanted. She did not let me read Forever by Judy Blume, because I think I was only like 9. And she said, honey, that book is too old for you. So I couldn't take that one out.
It's interesting because Forever does come up a lot on this podcast as the book that people aren't allowed to have and kind of have to kind of either sneak or pass around covertly. Did you ever read Forever?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I think I waited till I was older.
And were you disappointed by it? Was it as exciting as you thought it was going to be?
No, I mean, because by then I had already read Flowers in the Attic, right? And I'd snuck my parents' copy of Philip Roth's The Breast, which is, I think I read that when I was very young as well, where a man, it's like metamorphosis, except he turns into a breast instead of a cockroach. I haven't read that. I haven't read it for a very long time, but I remember reading that. So Forever was a little bit tame after that.
So these books, Lucy Andrews and Philip Roth, was there kind of a streak of purience there making you think, oh, this is an exciting other world I'm curious about? Or did you happen upon them by accident?
I happened upon them by... No, well, the V.C. Andrews everybody was reading in school. The Philip Roth my parents had, that was one of the very few books that they owned. I don't know if they still own it.
That's so weird to have barely any books, but to have The Breast.
They had that, and they had The Bad Seed. Do you remember that one about the evil little girl? They had that one too. I really, because they don't read horror. I loved it. I absolutely loved it, that one. I ate that one up, read that.
I can kind of picture a very pulpy cover, but I don't know if that is something that exists or just what you think of when someone says the word The Bad Seed.
Yeah, there was a blonde girl. They adopt a little girl and she ends up being evil and she doesn't want so she kills all the other kids and I think she kills the mother as well, does she? She kills everybody. She pushes them down the stairs and stuff. She's bad.
So it's Hamlet. Hamlet meets The Exorcist.
The Exorcist, too.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I guess they really went for 70s horror novels. They don't have those novels anymore. They've got rid of them. I love that book, The Exorcist.
So much now of anything that's, I suppose, you know, supernatural or a thriller where it's so rooted in the real and the domestic and the probable. Mm-hmm. And like all out horror as a very commercial genre, that I don't feel that we see that as much.
Not so much, no. I mean, I think there's a lot of nostalgia now for Stephen King, so still see him. And C.J. Tudor's books are very Stephen King-esque.
What was it like growing up in Maine with Stephen King as a presence? Was he the main guy, or did he come up?
Yeah. Because I love Stephen King, so I absolutely adore him. I've been reading him since I was, probably again 10 or 11. I've read all of, not all of them, because he writes so quickly, but I've read a lot. And he writes about the area where I grew up. So Castle Rock, where he sets a lot of things, is pretty much Rumford, Maine. So the last book I read, actually, was his Elevation, which is a novella set in Castle Rock. He's doing a lot of novellas set there. And I could recognize it. You know, the streets really sound like where I come from. And he lives not far. His sort of summer home is not far from there as well. So the landscape is really familiar, and the way people talk is really familiar. And we used to, you know, driving around my town as kids, we go, oh, that's Cujo's house over there. And that's where Tommyknockers happened. It's completely on our landscape.
Was that scary, or did it normalize the horror to be able to recognize all the places where it happened?
It's fine. Cujo's house, it's quite funny. He lives over there. Yeah.
What was it like? Because I know that your new book, Louis and Louise, which I adored and I will be raving about in the intro, but you must all buy it. It's so great. Writing about Maine, did that feel, like a way to sort of pay tribute to a place where you grew up and something that's very vivid and accessible? Or did you feel a lot of pressure to get Maine right?
Both, yes. Not to get it right so much as to be fair. Mm. I think Maine as a landscape is really important to me. And like, I love Stephen King, so it's in my writing. And then John Irving, I love John Irving. Mm. So that whole New England sort of setting, and I absolutely loved it. And I hope there was some tribute to John Irving in the novel as well. Like, I named the bar Meanies after Owen.
Oh, yes.
Owen Meany. And things like that, because one of the fathers called Irving. Because I love that sort of thing. But then if you're right, because Casablanca and Louis Louise is my hometown. It is. And pretty much all of the things that I write about did really happen or something very similar. But I had to be fair. And when I was writing it, I was really aware that people from my hometown were going to read it. And people from my hometown are very, very good people. They're very good people. And yet some bad things happened there and still do. And so I was trying to balance that, so I wasn't going to offend or upset anybody, but yet still be truthful about what's going on. So there goes my dog.
I really wanted to talk to you about John Irving. He just mentioned there's really beautiful, beautiful editions here. Are these all original hardbacks?
Yeah, they're Dave's. He can tell you about them. Are your John Irving's first edition?
Most of them, yeah.
So, yeah,
of course. I'm obsessed with collecting them.
Is he a writer that you discovered together?
No, I read him when I was a teenager. And then when we got together, we found out that we both loved him.
Oh, I think that's often such a big thing in a relationship, isn't it? And knowing who someone is and how you're going to feel about them because of loving the same thing.
Yeah, and these, beside all the John Irvings, are all the Kurt Vonnegut. So I remember on our first date, when we first met each other, we were, Dave was on stage, he was in a band, and I came to watch his band. And we got talking about Kurt Vonnegut. And that was right before we got together. So we both love him a lot.
This is the most amazing Irving Vonnegut shelf. Oh, and a Julian Barnes.
Arthur and George. Yeah, that's the one about Arthur Conan Doyle.
So perfect kind of confluence of your favourite things. Do you have a favourite John Irving novel?
It's Cider House Rules. I love it. It's set in Maine anyway, Cider House Rules, but it's about abortion, and I just love it. Actually, I say that, no, it's not. My favourite John Irving is A Prayer for Owen Meany, and that's not on the shelf. I don't know where that is. But Cider House Rules is my second favourite. Oh, it's such a good book. It's such an intensely human book, and a book about abortion written by a man. Mm. But it's just absolutely wonderful. Princes of Maine, Kings of New England. That's it. Oh, here in St. Cloud's, Dr. Larch wrote, we treat orphans as if they come from royal families.
Oh,
good. It's so good.
I would like that book to be read as widely as possible and read now. And obviously, didn't too badly. It was fine. John Irving is fine. But it's something that I'm surprised how quick we are to forget, I guess, when we think about reproductive rights. I don't know if you read the new J.G. Pickle book, A Spark of Light.
No, not the most recent one. No, I read the one before that.
Which I've not read the one before that. I liked A Spark of Light a lot, and it's about a seed and abortion clinic.
Yeah.
In real time. And I think a lot about how, in that, how little we know, and the people who feel so extremely about these things, I think, forget the humanity of all the people involved, and how books are so important and they serve to remind us that no one, I think, is entirely bad or good, unless they're the bad seed.
The bad seed was bad, but actually the bad seed, all she wanted was love. So, poor bad seed.
Poor bad seed.
Bonnie, her name was. I haven't read that book in 30 years, and I'm like, oh yeah, her name was Bonnie.
I have to track it down. So tell me about Kurt Vonnegut. When did you read him? What was the first book you read? Can you remember?
Yeah, Cat's Cradle.
And here it is. Wow, so look at, was it this edition that you read first?
No, I had a red paperback, but I think it had a picture of a cat's cradle on it.
So this is beautiful. This is a hardback. It looks like it possibly might be from a library originally, although I can't see any library markings.
So,
but it's got that sort of that shiny cover on, and inside it there's a bit of there's a pamphlet. I think from a, do you know what this is? This yours?
It must have come with the book, but it's from the Science Fiction Book Club. Because we forget that Kurt Vonnegut is a science fiction writer. He's not really treated like that anymore, but that's how he came up and that's how he was published. So that's a book club edition. So it must be from the Science Fiction Book Club. And Cat's Cradle is a science fiction novel. It's post-apocalyptic, about a plague, a scientific plague that kills everybody on Earth.
He had six kids.
Did he have six kids?
I mean, and that was in 1963, so heaven knows what happened after that. He did not have a bad seed.
I don't know much about his personal life, except, that he was a prisoner of war in Dresden. That's all I know about him.
So did you want to read him because you enjoyed science fiction? Or
yeah, I love science fiction, although I didn't really read him as science fiction. I read him as more philosophy, but and also his stories are great, and I love his language a lot. It's so simple and yet deceptive. I just think he's incredible, and his ideas are incredible. I mean, the idea, have you read Cat's Cradle?
No.
Oh, so the thing that kills everybody is something called ice 9, which is a molecule that can repattern water into ice at any temperature. Once a molecule of ice 9 touches water, all of it freezes. So if it touches a person, all of the water in your body freezes and you're dead. And it's a metaphor for nuclear arms. And it's got a character in there who develops it and who thinks that it's not going to cause any harm, but it's the thing that kills everybody. And
so what's the point of it?
What's the point of ice 9? I think because they could do it.
Other than if you're having a drinks party.
Yeah, they could. Yeah, it was something, they could just do it. They did it, so they did it. But yeah, Kurt Vonnegut has a character that recurs in lots of books called Kilgore Trout, who is basically himself. He's a pulp fiction writer who writes just absolute trash, but which is also absolute genius, and is underappreciated by everybody. Kilgore Trout is a real jerk.
That's such, I'm unappreciating my own time. It's a great idea. Have you ever been tempted to do that in your books?
Put myself in as an author? Well, I do write about authors an awful lot, which they tell you never to do, but I do.
Because I think that's really interesting in Louis and Louise. As a man, Louis is a successful author. Mm-hmm. As a woman, Louise is a sort of desperate, aspiring writer who's, struggling to find the time and the confidence to make it happen.
And I would love, because they eventually, it's not a spoiler, but in the book they have Louis and Louise being the same person, they both eventually write the same book. Mm. And it will turn out to be exactly, I think, pretty much the same book. But how both of them were published was something I really wanted to get into in the book, how Louise's book would look very different from Louis's book, even with the same words in it. But I didn't go there because I thought I might become a little bit bitter.
Oh, but I would really love that, wouldn't you? But there'd be a sort of, Louis would be like sort of very serious, critical choice, and the way it'd be sort of presented, and it'd be like, oh, we're going to get this New York Times. Whereas, you know, Louis, someone would say, we really want to publish you, but you need another 10,000 Instagram followers. We need to really think about a social strategy. And we're going to do a giveaway where you get to go for afternoon tea with in someone that looks like a log cabin.
Exactly. Yeah. Because Louis's book is called Light and Winter and it has a black and white cover. I think Louise's book would be called, Love in the Forest? And maybe have a high heel on it somewhere.
A high heel and a sort of like an axe leaning across it.
You and me in the woods. Yeah.
I'm curious about, because this book has your name on it, but I don't think I knew about this book. Can I ask you?
Yeah, sure. That was my first ever hardcover, so that's why I've got a copy of it on there. So it's got a lot of dust on it. You can tell how old that one is. One Night Stand was what my...
You wrote a book called Being a Bad Girl.
Yes. So I started out my career writing for Mills and Boone. And then I wrote a bunch of romantic comedies, and this is one of my romantic comedies called One Night Stand. And it's about a woman who, I think it was published in 2007, 2006. I was pregnant when I wrote it. It's about a woman who works in a bar and who writes erotic novels in her spare time. So I got to write a lot of erotic novels to go into this book. And one night she gets drunk and she has a one night stand with this guy who... looks like George Michael, but she doesn't know his name. And when she wakes up in the morning, she realizes the condom is broke and she's pregnant, but she doesn't know who this dude is. All she knows about him is that, she thinks he's called George and he looks like George Michael. So then she starts, it's set here in Reading, and she starts looking around Reading to try to find George.
So I'm really, really interested in your career and the books you write and your trajectory, because I think I absolutely love a romantic comedy. What was the first book you wrote for Mills and Boone, and what was that experience like?
Ah, well, I can show you. Shall I show you?
Please do.
Okay, but they're all up in my attic, so why don't I? Can I? Shall I bring them down?
We can go up.
Come up to my attic. We might not all fit. Come on, I'll show you. see what you want to do, because it's not a real attic. It's not a real room.
This is really good. I don't think we've ever been in an attic before. I mean, on a show. Do you work up here? Oh, it's your office.
Yes, my office.
Oh, fantastic.
So, it's an unusual way to get up to an attic. So we had a carpenter build a staircase like a ship's staircase. So it is quite narrow and difficult to get up. But on purpose, you know, I don't like people up here.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. It's good. I'm not working.
So if I can just describe it a little bit, this is really... really, really lovely. It's quite a big space. I can see massive books. And yeah, this is where the magic happens, I guess.
That's where the mess happens. I have a view of a gargoyle. Can you see the gargoyle's butt on my skylight?
Yes.
I'm in a Victorian terraced house with a little gargoyle on the top.
Is that when you came to look around, were you like, yes, the gargoyle, I will take this house, please.
Yes, I will own this house, please.
Please, can I ask you about your signed picture of Owen Wilson?
That was a gift. I had a real big crush on him about 10 years ago when he was in Shanghai Noon with Jackie Chan. I love that film.
It's Hansel I love.
Oh, I love him as Hansel. That's great. I just saw that the other day.
That is my ultimate crush.
That's all of The Princess Bride.
Oh, wow.
Poster. Yeah, I love that book so much. So much. And I love the movie as well.
When did you read the book?
I saw the movie first, I think. The thing is about the book, have you read the book? Because it's quite, it's exactly the same story as the movie, but the movie is about The Princess Bride, and the book is about William Goldman. And so there's a lot in there about his relationship, it's fictionalized, obviously, but there's a lot in there about his relationship with his son and his wife, and there's a lot in there about being a screenwriter. And so the book is not as child-friendly as the movie is, but it has extra added depths to it. with having all the same things that are in the movie, just extra stuff about William Goldman.
Which movie were you most disappointed by having loved the book?
Oh, God, so many. So many. That's, see, now you got me on the spot. So, yeah, so these are all my books, except for Together and Louis and Louise is down there. So I wrote six Mills and Boons, which are here. The first one was called Featured Attraction.
Oh my God, they're just, these covers are amazing.
They're great.
They're just so classic. Did you have any kind of input at all? Did they say like, here's your cover? Or did you even see them before they came out?
No. Well, yeah, like a week before they come out. So, and most of the time, not the titles either. So what you do when you write a Mills and Boon is you write a story and then they have you fill out this long thing about the cover sheet, who should be on there and what the protagonist looked like and all of that. And then they ignore that and just find you a stock photo of two people kissing.
So if I may, I'm going to describe these. So this is the first one.
Yeah, that I wrote that.
Attraction by Judy Kern. Longer story for only $3.19. And this is this very attractive, beautiful sort of chiseled brunette couple. He's got a touch of the Ben Stillers. She looks not unlike Kate Middleton, but a sort of Hallmark movie version of Kate Middleton. But I don't know if I'm allowed to say that. He's bare-chested. Mm. She's got a sort of satiny white camisole on, but it almost looks like a sort of a bit of surgical gowning or something. That angle, you can just sort of see a cup and a strap. Now we've got Being a Bad Girl. Oh my God.
Isn't that great?
This is my favourite one.
She's from the 80s. Look
at her. She is Kylie. Is she Charlene in Neighbours? Was that Kylie? Biker jacket, ripped jeans. That guy. Oh my. And this, I love the way. So you've got this guy with massive, massive arms. They're both on a motorbike. His kind of, not quite, it's like a cap sleeve sort of like man shirt, but it's billowing. So I don't think he's got, it looks like he's got a proper sort of matronly boob on him.
He's wearing a leather vest. Look, I think that's...
Oh, so that's the lining of the vest.
The lining of his leather.
It's Delicious next. Ooh, yeah. Black and white, very noir.
I think she's wearing the same slip as the first person. And I'm pretty sure these are all the same dude.
Yes!
Maybe not, but they're very similar looking.
They could be brothers. I would love that so much. Can that please be your next book about a family of brothers who will end up as sort of sexy 80s catalogue models? And their dad invented the genre or something. So they're snogging in a sink. Now we've got Driving Him Wild. And I think, is that supposed to be a cut or is that just a, no, that's just a sort of a swishy bit. They're both in T-shirts. That could be a Jackie photo story or something.
It could be, yeah. He's quite mature, he's got very hairy arms.
I like her. Oh, that's his hands and her hair. I thought she had a really elaborate barrette system going on. All work and no play. Again, a bit like this is a lot steamier looking. It's because it's a bit blurred. It looks a little bit like a still from an XS video or something.
That was a sex comedy, essentially a sex comedy, that book. It was a mistaken identity, friends to lovers. You use a lot of tropes in Mills and Boone, and you try to have lots of fun with them.
Can I read out a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, that book was published in 2007. So just so listeners know that my my prose style is slightly different these days. But I loved writing these books hugely. They were so much fun.
Tell me one more thing, Johnny. Just information, and then I'll leave you in peace for now. What's your wildest fantasy? He was being driven insane by desire, and he typed furiously, without slowing down to let his brain think about what he was communicating. We can't wait for dinner to be over. We get up and leave together, and when we're outside in the cool spring air, we immediately touch each other. We slide our hands inside each other's clothing, and we touch whatever skin we can, kissing and exploring, not caring about the other people walking past us in the evening. Our clothes are in the way, but that's exciting too, because every touch promises even more. Ooh! Can I borrow this?
Yeah. That one's really steamy. So they're best friends, but they haven't seen each other in 15 years, and so they don't know what each other look like. And they email every day. And so she, but he is, of course, he's a computer geek, but he, of course, moonlights as a male model. Because you course. Do. So, and she is an advertising executive who's just, who's having trouble with her job. So she hires this male model just from his headshots and doesn't recognize that it's really her friend. And she ends up having a date with this guy. And Johnny thinks that she knows who he is, but she doesn't. So when she's asking about like his sexual fantasies, he's typing out and she doesn't know that it's with the guy she's going to have a date. So then they go and do everything. And then she finds out and there's trouble. it was hugely fun to write that book.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and t-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
We'll be back to Julie soon, but now it's time for my Steal of the Week, a book so good that the Hamburglar would eat it with chips. This week it's a children's classic, Carbonell by Barbara Slay, first published in 1955 and recommended to me by a fabulous friend of your book to the writer Anne Booth. Carbonell is the king of the cats, but he has been cursed into servitude until Rosemary acquires him by accident during her school summer holiday and attempts to set him free. This is utterly charming and uplifting. Gentle, gorgeous, and genuinely funny. It's the perfect book for anyone who could do with a little bit more love and levity in their lives. Carbonell is published by Puffin and out now. Now back to Julie. So how did you start? Did you know anyone who did? Or did you just think, oh, I'd love to do that?
I just thought I would love to do it. So when I first decided I wanted to be a writer, I knew I wanted to write something, but I didn't know what. So I have quite eclectic reading tastes. I like, you know, literary fiction, science fiction, and I like very commercial fiction as well. And I thought very naively that I would, since I didn't know what kind of book I wanted to write, but I knew I wanted to write a book, I thought, well, I'll try to write a Mills and Boone because I know that they're short and I know what kind of stories they are and how hard can it be? And it turns
hard,
out,
right? Yeah,
in actual fact, it's very, very difficult to write a Mills and Boone and get it published. It's very hard to do because you have all of these marketing constraints and yet you have to write a very convincing story. It can't be by the numbers at all. And you have to train yourself how to write that. So I took a few years and trained myself how to write in that way, which also taught me a lot about things about conflict and characterization and pacing, then I could carry through.
How did
later
you train yourself?
Too.
Did you read masses of Mills?
I read huge amounts of them and I don't have them around anymore. I have some down there, but I don't have them around anymore because I would read lots and lots and lots and then I've got rid of them since. So I read tons of them. I wrote a bunch of them that got rejected and just enjoyed it a lot. Got to know a lot of stuff about story structure and conflict. Because if your book is about two people who basically love each other but can't be together until the final, you know, you have to spend 50,000 words keeping these people apart. Mm. And there's only so much, you know, ex-girlfriends and big misunderstandings you can use. You need to have a lot of deep conflict in there.
So when they sort of came back and said no, did they have lots of constructive criticism about what the story needed to make it work? Was it get useful information?
Yeah, they did. Yeah, they were great. And I had a mentor who's Kate Walker, who had written, I think she's written 50 Mills and Boons and really successful. And so she helped me a lot with writing those two. But when I was writing those, I was quite lucky because I got rejected so many times that I started writing a standalone novel too, and a romantic comedy, and I got an agent for that at the same time that I got my Mills and Boon publishing deal. So I had two strands going at the same time. So there are six books here, but five of them were published in 2006. And that one was published in 2007.
Did you write them all in a year?
This book was published in 2006.
So that's Spirit Willing, Flesh Week. That's got a fabulous cover. Yeah. I love you've got a very sexy fortune teller. Yeah. I guess another little black dress book. I love her her starry dress and her flicky hair and a very handsome hunky Batman.
Yeah, that was Owen Wilson. That was at the height of my Owen Wilson crush.
Do you remember that Aquafresh advert with the cartoon family brushing their teeth? Yeah. He's got such a big chin and such fabulous teeth.
But yeah, I think I wrote three of these in a year. I got my first deal in 2004, and then I had six of them published by 2006. So that's three a year.
How did you keep going? Because it sounds as though you were very enjoying of the process.
I loved it.
I think I'd have been really demoralised if, you know, my second or third one was like, you know, they said no. I think, oh, well, balls to this, I'm going to be a welder. But you, obviously, looking at the, you know, the shelf of prolificness, you just kept going.
I really got my teeth in and I was like, I'm not going to fail in this. I'm going to do it. But then I really loved it. As I said, these Mills and Boons are so much fun to write. I mean, I would swear and whatever, but they are pure pleasure because they're happy books and they're really fast paced and mine were funny. Tons of sex in them. I love writing sex. I just enjoyed it. And I was teaching full time at the time. And actually, a lot of that time, when I wrote three in a year. I wrote these three in a year when I was having miscarriages every few months. So we're trying for a baby and I lost three pregnancies within a year. And I also wrote three books in a year, two of them about pregnancies. Isn't that awful?
Wow.
But it helped me get through that as well. Gosh, to write these happy stories.
Strange sort of symmetry.
It was really intense. Yeah. And I was teaching full time.
Were you teaching English?
Teaching English.
That's a hell of a thing to assume. But just,
yeah.
I was teaching computer science. Like, damn you, the many strands of brilliance.
No, I'm really only good at one thing. I was teaching at a girls' Catholic boarding school in Ascot, very posh, and the girls were very, very nice, and I enjoyed it a lot. But I was writing these incredibly sexy books in my spare time.
Thinking, screw you, Nance. What was your favourite book to teach?
I loved teaching Pride and Prejudice, and I loved teaching Far From the Madding Crowd.
Oh, that's quite a disparate selection.
Yeah, those were for the older kids. And with the younger kids, I used to love teaching Holes by Louis Satchar. Love that book. That was great.
I've not read it for so long, but I remember reading it. I think one of my little sisters had it, and I just sort of picked it up in that, you know, you pick everything up, you know, knowing it's not sort of especially for me, but really idly, you know, starting it and then just being gripped.
Yeah, it's a really clever book about storytelling as well as just being a good book for kids.
Did any of your students come up with any ideas or theories or observations that blew your mind a bit and things that hadn't occurred to you?
Yeah, all the time, especially in A-level. I used to love teaching A-level, and think they would come up with things quite often. Yeah. Although with the A-level group, I would just go through like Wuthering Heights and point out all the sex references. And like, oh, Miss Cohen!
That sounds really, really fun. Is there anything that you, any books, if you were to go back, that you would love to teach?
So many. So many. I think you get to know a book really well by teaching it. Mm. I know Pride and Prejudice so well because I have taught that book. And Wuthering Heights. Mm. I have taught those books each, you know, half a dozen times or more. And Romeo and Juliet and Macbeth. I know those so well. And because you have to break them down for younger readers, you get to know them structurally. And I'm a real structure person. You can see that's my latest novel on the wall with the post-its. I'm really into structure, and I'm really into how you break it down. And breaking down Jane Austen taught me a huge amount. Pride and Prejudice is such a well-structured book. You know, it has all the turning points in the right places. And everybody has everybody is Pride or Prejudice or both. And in every single thing that happens, there's that interplay of that theme. It's an extraordinarily well-constructed book.
Because I think that Austen writes these very, very vivid characters and these real human archetypes. And we sort of continue to think of them in that way and use them in that way. And I think perhaps it is the mark of a really great writer when the structure is so good that we almost don't notice it, and it requires that close reading.
Yeah, so good. If you have you ever broken down Pride and Prejudice?
No, but that I'm going to go straight home and do that now.
And just see how the arc works, and where the midpoint reversal is, and you know where she realizes that she loves him after all. No, it's not that. The midpoint reversal is his proposal.
Mm. And I suppose perhaps, you know, with a romantic comedy, because you know where you're driving people at, and you've somehow got to keep that element of surprise. Mm-hmm. And so the what isn't surprising, but the how is so surprising. And perhaps that's what Austen does and what you do.
Yeah, that's what...
No one else, just you guys.
just us, yeah.
I'm going to have a nosy look at your post-its, and I'm not going to read any out because I don't want to do any spoilers.
I think I didn't bother to chart the last few scenes. I think there's more down here because I just finished it.
So is it sort of, do you think in scenes rather than in chapters?
Yes. Or? Story events rather than scenes. Sometimes a story event takes several scenes. And sometimes there are several story events per scene.
And do you start with, I don't know, 5 or 10 key scenes and then add and move? Or do you know exactly what all the scenes are?
No. It depends on the book. So this book it has taken me a long time to write, and I wrote a really, really messy draft, which sucked a lot. So then I had to go back and rewrite it so it made sense. And this is the map that I made as I was doing my sort of final revision. So I was charting where I had been, because I had so many versions of the book, I couldn't remember where I was and what was happening.
Did you do that with your editor, or did you go on your own with the first draft?
Oh, yeah, because the first draft is awful. I never let anybody see my drafts.
Oh, really?
No, because they're terrible.
Not even your publisher.
No, nobody sees my draft. I need to have it as perfect as I can make it before anybody sees it. I'm a little bit anally retentive.
Do you go to writer friends when you're stuck, when something's a bit knotty, and without actually showing them the draft, do you ever get them to talk you through a...
Yeah.
Not.
Yeah, really often. And in fact, I think that time before we were in France together, I had a couple of days with Kate Harrison, and I didn't know what was going to happen in Louis and Louise to Benny. Mm. And I spent some time with her just talking that through. She was the one who actually came up with the baseball accident. That doesn't give anything away, but there's something that happens in the book to one of the characters, and she was the one who came up with it when we were sharing a bunch of rosé. But I don't show drafts. We just talk through what's going on. And in fact, that makes it maybe even that's a little bit more scary now. So my draft for this novel that's on the wall is currently with my editor. And the only person who's read it in the world besides me is my agent, who I trust. But, you know, she's on my side, right? So so it's with my editor now. So I am currently essentially shitting bricks.
Are these mainly research books?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Let's talk about these.
Yeah, mostly research, but research for books that have happened a long time ago. And I have a lot of books there as well that are books that have been published by my clients. So I run a literary consultancy.
Oh, yes. I want to ask
and,
you about that.
And some of those are published books from my clients.
So how did you get into that? Were you doing that once you'd started, you know, writing and publishing books, or was that happening when you were teaching?
It was when I was already writing and publishing, and I'm trying to think. I was teaching. I was doing a lot of teaching and workshops and things. And I think it was actually Claire McIntosh who got me started in it, because her first book, I Let You Go, she had an agent interested in it, but there were some structural problems with it that she didn't know how to solve. So she got in touch with me out of the blue. I think I'd done a workshop at the Chipping Norton Literary Festival, and she got in touch with me out of the blue and said, can you read this book and tell me what you think? And it it has the most amazing twist. This is the book that sort of started off all the shocking twist. It has the most amazing twist.
That book is massive, isn't it?
Absolutely huge. And so I read that at manuscript and I was like, oh my God, this twist. And then helped her with some of the structural aspects around there and characterization. And then after that, I was like, oh, I quite like this, working on people's books for money. So I've started doing that more.
Yeah.
But it's great to have the book. Then the book comes to you afterwards. And it's so exciting to know that you helped with that. It's more satisfying than your own.
And I bet you show up in people's like dedications and thanks and things.
Yes, it's so cool.
That's awesome.
I love that.
So how did you tend to get a mix? Or does it tend to be kind of before the books have an agent or a publisher? Or does it sometimes happen at different stages of the journey?
It's before they're agented. I think agents and editors want to have their own stamp on a book. So I wouldn't do that. But it's usually unpublished or people who are moving to a new genre. So I'm working with somebody right now who has written a bunch of children's books, but this is her first novel. So I work with her on that.
Oh, should we go back down?
So there's another hand grip down. You're almost at the railing there. And there's another hand grip on your right.
I don't know why I'm such a wuss about this. It's entirely sort of psychological. It shouldn't make any difference how I go down these stairs.
Yeah.
I did once fall off Nelson's column.
Oh, Goodsworth.
trying to get down. A little bit down.
No, we're talking about the books on this shelf.
Which I just totally missed.
Stranger Beside Me, about Ted Bundy by Anne Rule. And this is her first true crime. And she actually knew him. She volunteered on a suicide helpline with him in Seattle.
So he was a volunteer. Ted Bundy
was a volunteer, so she knew him.
That's so fucking
and
weird.
And used to talk to him when he was in prison. And then she went on to have a real career in true crime. And this is a really, really good true crime. It's absolutely fascinating. But actually, reading this, and I probably read this book 10 times, reading this and then watching the Netflix documentary, he comes across much better in this because actually in person, he was a real dick. I mean, unsurprisingly, because he raped and murdered 30 women. But people keep on saying about how he was really charming and he was really smart. And if you watch the Netflix documentary, he really comes across as an asshole. And you're just like, why were people charmed by this dickhead?
He wasn't just a serial killer. He was a dick.
But the whole narrative about Ted Bundy is that he was so charming and smart and he was such a... The judge at his trial said, it's such a waste. I mean, he was telling Ted Bundy, who killed 30 women, that his life was a waste. I mean, but how awful is that?
I suppose we have that so much now. You know, had the number of, like, you know, family man, beloved by everybody, his neighbours say he was great, he killed his wife and kids and himself.
Yeah, exactly.
Why are you interested in murderers?
I have no idea. I have no idea. I mean, real murderers are obviously terrible. But I have a real thing about fictional ones. And I also do really like true crime, well-written true crime.
Is it because the how is so interesting? You know, the
why.
The doing it in a... Or the...
The why, the psychology, I think.
That it's so... Because it's so alien. And I suppose, as a writer, your job is to kind of understand all kinds of desire. And I think any novel is really about the desires people have.
And a lot of it is just misogyny. So it's interesting from a feminist perspective as well, just to see how, I mean, that Ted Bundy narrative is so misogynistic, just centering him instead of the 30 women he killed. And so there's a grotesque horror. With Hallie Rubenhold's books coming out this week, wasn't it? The Five, about the victims instead of about Jack the Ripper. I loved her book about the Covent Garden sex workers. That's really good. That's about Harris's list of prostitutes working in Covent's Garden. And so talking about all the different women who work there and what their careers were like. That's very good.
I don't think I know about Harris's list. Was this in Victorian times?
Yeah, or? It was like a directory of for guys who wanted to have sex with women for money. No, not Victorian. No, I think it was 18th century.
Is this Dave's as well, the 33 and the third?
Yeah, about the birds. Yeah.
If you were going to write one about a band or a particular... Because they're all about particular records, aren't they? Or are they about particular records? What record would you write a book about?
Oh, well, Carrie and Lowell by Subjan Stevens.
Ah!
I love that album so much.
Would you want to write about how it was made and about Subjan Stevens? Or would you want to write a story kind of based on your interpretation of it?
I would like to write a story. It's so narrative. That album is so narrative. And I listened to it constantly while I was writing Together. And then I sent a copy of my book to Safjan, and who I don't know personally, but I feel like I do. And I got a message back from Lowell, who is his manager, his stepfather, is the Lowell and Carrie and Lowell. He wrote back to me and said, oh, I'm so pleased that you listened to this album while you're writing the book. I'm going to buy it for myself. I was like, oh my God! It was like touching a celebrity.
That's really, really cool. That's so cool. What did you listen to when you were writing Louis Louise?
I think I mostly listened to Chopin's Nocturnes when I was doing that, but also a variety of 80s hits too.
Do you read any novels when you're writing?
Yes, but I try to read something that's very different from what I'm writing. Yeah.
So, and do you ever kind of, that you know, what you're reading is too much and too distracting from you, or do you tend
that's
to have quite good instincts?
That's why I try not to read anything that's anything like what I'm writing when I'm reading it.
Should we get that down? I should mention that we're walking down the stairs and there are many, many, many Percy Jacksons. I see. There must be about 20.
Yeah. That's my son. He's 12. And he reads them all repeatedly. So they're all quite well thumbed as well, because he likes to read books over and over again. I think that's a comfort thing when you're at that age. And so he's read all of them a lot.
Do you reread very often?
Yes, I do. Yeah, there are certain books that I reread over and over again. Sometimes when you need comfort as well, they're real things.
So, what do you think you've read the most?
Aside from that Ted Bundy one... author. My favorite book is Ted Bundy.
And also, for your comfort read?
Yeah, that's not my comfort read. No, I love The Grand Sophie by Georgette Heyer. That's one of my comfort reads, although it's a recent comfort read. Watership Down is a real comfort read. When I'm sick, I like things where I know what's going to happen. Sherlock Holmes, I reread that as a comfort read. The real comfort reads are the things that you read when you were a kid, aren't they? And then you come back and you know that they're...
And that there's no peril. And when the peril happens, you do know it's temporary, that it's all you're leading to a good place. So I really wanted to ask you about your experience of publishing Together, the book before Louis and Louise. I know we've talked about it a bit, but the difficulty in terms of the way you were treated by your publishers and that you wrote a book that I don't think they were expecting, and what happened next, because I think it's really interesting, as you know, because that book has been so successful and so beloved, and you know, even Richard and Judy were fans, I believe. So can you tell me a bit about what happened?
I wrote that book. It was my fourth novel for that publisher. I'd had two book contracts, so it was the last book in the second two book contract. And I had written a synopsis and discussed the book a lot with my editor. And then I delivered it. But soon after I delivered it, she left the company and went to another publisher. And so I had a different editor. And the new editor didn't like the ending. It's got a twist ending. So Together is about a couple who have been together for 50 years. And it starts at the end of their life, when they're in their 80s, and then it goes backwards through time to 1962 when they first met, and the big secret that they've been keeping their entire lives. And the big secret was always the same thing. I had never changed it. It was always a thing. But my new editor and the team decided that the ending was way too controversial and that they did not want to publish the novel with that ending. And so they told me that, and they suggested some other things that they thought would be more suitable. And I was actually really shocked by this, because the whole novel, you know, if you write an ending, and especially if the whole novel is about that ending, every single line in that novel is about what happens and about that secret. And if you change the secret, it would change the entire book and the point of the book. I wanted readers to finish the book and go, whoa, I need to talk about this with somebody. I was not looking to write an uncontroversial book. I wanted it. And that was always the selling point, was that it was something to talk about. But my publishers really felt that they wanted a much more straightforward commercial book, and therefore that I should change the ending. And so I thought about it for a really long time. Well, for four months, probably. I went through and I constructed alternate endings. I tried to figure out what was going on. I made huge lists of pros and cons or whatever. But in the end, I figured that there was no change I could make for that book that wouldn't make it worse. If I could find a change that would make it the same, it would be okay. But I couldn't find a way that wouldn't make it worse. And so I left the publisher and I paid back all the money that they had paid me for that book. And then fortunately was taken on by Orion, who really saw the ending as a strength and made their whole marketing campaign pretty much about that ending.
You know, what I know about you is that you're, you know, someone who's got a lot of kind of strength and fortitude, and that you write and write and write and you're not a quitter, but just, this has just been debilitating.
It was terrible. I mean, because it was my 23rd novel, so it wasn't a new thing for me. You know, I'd been doing this for a long time, 23rd published novel. It wasn't new, and so I had always felt, my editors had always really given me very good advice, so it was quite difficult. And I always say to other authors or new authors, you know, your editor is almost always going to say exactly the thing to make it better.
Yeah.
And, you know, you really should think about it. So I did think about it, but it was difficult for me, and we just had a fundamental misunderstanding of what that book should be about. But it made me question my abilities as a writer, and it made me question my own vision and the worth of what I was doing a lot. I had writer's block for 18 months afterwards. Not that I couldn't write anything, but I was writing lots of things, but I couldn't finish anything, which I think is pretty telling, because I was quite afraid of that. Even though I had a really fantastically supportive agent, new publisher who were 100% behind me, the book was doing really well, I really didn't get rid of that writer's block. I had to have counseling to get rid of that writer's block, to really understand why I wasn't trusting myself and get over that.
Was there anything that was revealed to you that surprised you in that process?
There was a lot that surprised me. I think it went back to my 20s and when I had a lot of self-doubt, and a lot of those feelings sort of came back to the surface.
Can we look at your books? That I know this is your to-read pile.
Although some of them I have read. I've read some of
and
them already.
I've said it before, but I'll say it again. I like that your own book is in your to-read pile. So of these, what are you the most excited about reading next?
Everybody tells me I need to read Sally Rooney's Normal People. So, and that just got longlisted for the Women's Prize last night, so I need to read that. That's good. I've actually already read some of these, so
I've not read Normal People yet. I bought it, and I don't know why, because I'm sort of really, I think there's so much I have to read for work. I know I'm going to enjoy this. I want to save it.
Yeah, I'm really looking
it's
forward
very
to
shiny
that.
Edition
it's very well. Shiny it looks, it's very beautiful. I think it's the Waterstone special hardback.
What's that, Jackie really? Collins?
Oh, the Jackie Collins is there re-releasing her books, all of her books, with introductions by popular women's fiction authors. So I've got The World is Full of Divorced Women there, which is introduced by Veronica Henry. But they also have Thrill, introduced by Barbara Taylor Bradford. And so it's exciting.
That looks really, really fun.
Doesn't it look good?
Don't they look like the great, really 70s covers?
Yeah, love it.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, that's for a train where I can really enjoy myself.
You can really immerse yourself in that world.
Yeah.
Have you read Educated by Tara Westover?
I loved it so much. So good, and really quite shocking. I enjoyed that book a lot. That's the book that I bought for everybody for Christmas.
Ah, that's a good book to give the gift. What's the last book that you were given that you loved?
People don't give me books as presents, do
you
know? Which is weird. My brother gave me a book called The Spirit Hits You When You Fall Down, which is a medical book, nonfiction, and it's about the an epileptic girl in the, I think it's pronounced Hmong community in California, and about what happened to her because of culture clashes between her community and the medical community. It's an extraordinary nonfiction book. That's the last book that somebody gave me that I loved.
That's a really good, specific, thoughtful gift book. Yeah, I think.
He's a doctor, so we both love medical memoirs. So I gave him Adam Kay for fun, and he gave me that.
Huge thanks to Julie. Show her your love at Julie_Cohen on Twitter and JulieXCohen on Instagram, and rush out and read Louis and Louise. It's one of my very favourite books of 2019. Julie is such an emotionally smart and empathetic writer, and she makes us all think and feel better. I'm Daisy Buchanan, and I've been your book inspector. Thank you so much for joining me, Bibliognostic Babes. You can find me on Twitter at NotRollerGirl and on Instagram at TheDaisyBee. Say hello, suggest some guests, and watch out for shelfies. Visit our show page, acast.com/booked, for more information about our guest and a list of the books they've talked about. If you have any other queries about the podcast, email us at whybooked@gmail.com. Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. Please do subscribe, rate us, and leave a review. It's great to hear what you think, and it helps other people find the podcast. I'll see you next time. For now, I leave you with the words of Agatha Christie via Danielle Steele. I want to die face first in my typewriter.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.